rabbis, or pastors. They are the go-to guys for life's problems. Yet when it comes to your business, who is your go-to guy? Who's on the front line with your customers? The bishop in business's chess match is your customer service and how you treat people who buy your product or service. The objective of customer service in any business should serve one function, similar to our men of the cloth, and that is to help, support, and resolve. My internal roadmap, my black book. The Fastlane roadmap was my compass for wealth, but I also had an internal roadmap, and no, it wasn't my business plan. It was my little black book. Nope, my black book wasn't a treasure trove of telephone numbers from female hotties, but a written record of all complaints, grievances, and issues my business experienced daily. This book has served as my guide for over a decade. When business owners hear a complaint, most of them ignore it. Most of them pass the buck to an employee and pray the issue goes away. Not in the fast lane. Complaints are a beautiful thing. They represent free feedback and expose unmet needs in your business. They represent the journey's road noise. I log my customers' complaints because they provided a kaleidoscope into the mind of my customers. One complaint meant there were 10 other people who felt the same way. When my black book accumulated similar complaints weekly, I had to evaluate the issue and take corrective action. Complaints are the world's whispers hinting the direction you should be moving. The four types of road noise. Complaints. When the world unleashes its opinion on your new website, product, or concept, what should you expect? What should be addressed, and what should be ignored? There are four types of complaints. Number one, complaints of change. Number two, complaints of expectation. Number three, complaints of void. And number four, complaints of fraud. Complaints of change. Take anything that people love, change it, and you'll have a riot at the steps of your business. Remember when Coke changed its formula? Oh my God, how dare they? Remember when Fox canceled the feel-good drama Party of Five? Dear God, the world hates change, and it's a natural human behavior to resist it. Change endangers comfort, expectancy, and security. When I redesigned my website and hundreds of complaints poured in, I expected a certain degree of resistance. It's normal. In fact, every redesign I've ever done in 10-plus years was met with resistance. The question for critique was, how much was normal and how much was legitimate? Complaints of change are the least informative and therefore the most ones difficult to decipher. For my redesign failure, data confirmed that the complaints were substantial. Bounce rates tripled and my conversion ratio suffered. I had to suck up the failure, revert back, and start over. When you change, there will be complaints, guaranteed. And yes, not all of them are actionable simply because human psychology is in play, not the integrity of your work. Complaints of expectation. Complaints of expectation occur when you negatively violate the expectation of your customer. You convince them to do business with you, they expect something, and what you provide doesn't meet the expectation. This happens because either your service failed or their expectation was malformed by a deceptive marketing strategy. Regardless of which, both exposes a problem. And it's your problem, not the customer's. You either need to do a better job in fulfillment or a better job in managing their expectations.
Your service sucks.
I heard that complaint hundreds of times, and yet my company not only survived, it thrived. If my service sucked, and I was being told it sucked, how did my business succeed? I dug into the claims. Advertisers who complained, "Your service sucks," didn't use my service as intended. Their expectations were malformed. I owned a lead generation service that sent email leads to clients. The thing about leads is they must be followed. You don't book leads after they sit in your email box for 3 weeks and then answer them like a first grader. You don't book leads when you log into your account once every millennium. Yes, indeed, my service sucks when it isn't used properly. Instead of targeting my customer, I sought to better manage expectations. I made it abundantly clear that leads are only as good as the person following them. Unfollowed leads go unbooked. Also, because most of my customers weren't communicatively savvy, I launched educational campaigns to ensure professional responses. If I couldn't manage the complaints, I could manage the expectations. I knew if my customers were making money, they'd keep paying me. You see, when you order sea bass at a restaurant and it's served raw, your expectation of a well-cooked meal is violated. You complain. Yet for the owner, there is a bigger problem. Why was it raw? Is the chef incompetent? Does the kitchen process need a retooling? Complaints of expectation expose operational issues, marketing misinformation, and/or product problems. If you hire a home remodeler who advertises guaranteed bathroom remodels in 2 weeks and the job takes 2 months, your expectations are violated and either the marketing campaign needs to reflect the truth or the operation needs to be retooled to fit the expectation. Either way, the operations or the marketing needs to change. Complaints of expectation violate customer expectations negatively. Complaints avoid. Complaints avoid are when your customer continually requests something and you simply don't have it. Complaints avoid are extremely valuable as they expose unmet needs. Early in my lead generation days, one of the most common complaints I'd receive from limousine service owners was, "We don't do weddings." Customers would request limousines for weddings and some providers didn't offer wedding service. Likewise, many providers didn't do airport transfers. These kind of complaints piled in and a pattern emerged. So I added a website feature that allowed providers to specify the types of services they offered. Problem solved. By fixing the issue, I raised the value of my leads. Higher value equals greater magnitude, higher profits, and growing asset values. Complaints avoid are gold mines of opportunity. People freely tell you what they want, and you don't have to pay for it. Unmet needs are served up on a silver platter. Complaints of fraud. In March 2005, a woman entered a Wendy's restaurant and claimed that a dismembered human finger was in her bowl of chili. Her intent was not only to complain, but also to sue. Fortunately, the fraudulent complaint was thwarted after the woman's litigious past was exposed. The following month, Las Vegas police arrested the woman for grand larceny. At the bottom of the barrel are fraudulent complaints. Ask any business owner and they'll confirm fraudulent complaints are the most disheartening because they reflect the worst of society, illegitimate complaints designed to exploit the business owner. I had to deal with fraudulent complaints almost weekly. A customer typos a price and some idiot thinks they're entitled to a limo for $5 an hour versus the $50 an hour. You owe me or I will contact my attorney and sue. Yes, I'm sure you have an attorney. Good luck with that, champ. You're going to pay a lawyer $250 an hour to fight over a typographical error amounting to $45? Do you know what kind of idiot you sound like? When you deal with millions of customers, you will encounter hundreds of sidewalkers determined to get theirs. Yes, it can make you cynical because complainers intending to exploit are low-class frauds. When you drop a fly in your soup, hoping you can get a free meal, sorry, but you're a crook. How do you deal with exploitive complainers? You respond once, with grace, explain your position, and move on. Pick your battles. Bill Crosby once said, "I don't know the key to success, but the key to failure is trying to please everybody." I started my business with an overzealous passion to make everyone happy. That soon proved to be insanity. Complaints need to be managed with a balance, which is why I kept records. I wanted to identify patterns that would enhance the value of my service. I knew better products produce better customers, and better customers pay well. Nowadays, it's easy to follow the complaints for your business. Twitter.com offers owners the ability to keep track of what customers say. Google Alerts can notify you when a website mentions your company name. Keeping track of the feedback is getting easier, but deciphering the noise is getting more difficult.
"I don't want to pay for your service."
Yes, some complaints need to be ignored. If you try to make everybody happy, you'll drive yourself nuts. Pick your battles. Solve complaints that add the most value while helping the most. As a business owner, you must remember that while you don't have a boss, the person who pays your mortgage is your customer, and they always should be heard, but sometimes ignored. Use sucks to your advantage. No need to sugarcoat it. Customer service in the modern age sucks. We have become so swamped by poor customer service experiences from the businesses in our life that we now accept crappy customer service as a standard of expectation. Have you ever called a computer manufacturer for support? Or called your big national bank? Or called your health insurance provider? Sucks, sucks, and double sucks. Customer service today has become a lost art. Our expectation of service with businesses has become so pathetic that we become numb to expect nothing but disinterest. Down the block from my home, there's a strip mall with a corner restaurant that changes ownership every 6 months. Since I've lived in the neighborhood, 4 restaurants have opened and 4 have closed. While I can't comment on the first 3 failures, I can on the last. When I dined at the latest incarnation of the restaurant, the food was decent, but the service was deplorable. Drinks went unfilled. The silverware was dingy. The waitress was arrogant, as if our patronage was an inconvenience. After leaving, I thought, that place ain't gonna last. And sure enough, a few months later, the sign went up. For lease. While bad customer service is frustrating while playing our consumer role, it gives us entrepreneurs great opportunity. Where customer service lacks, unearths great opportunity. You see, the beauty of expectation is that it works in reverse. While complaints of expectation are about violating of expectations negatively, customer service that sucks, S-U-C-S, is about violating expectations positively. Exchange sucks, S-U-C-K-S, for sucks, S-U-C-S. You can explode your business into the stratosphere by deploying a customer service strategy that exceeds expectations. I call it sucks, S-U-C-S, or superior unexpected customer service. We all expect a certain level of suckage when it comes to customer service. This is an advantage for fastlaners. For example, if I discover a $10,000 fraudulent withdrawal on my bank statement, my first instinct is to freak out. My second instinct is to call the bank to resolve the problem. Now, at that point, my brain immediately creates a smorgasbord of expectations for the call to the bank. Here is my expectation profile, or what I expect. I expect to hear a recorded message or an automated attendant. I expect to press a never-ending menu of buttons. Press 1 for this, press 2 for that, or press 3 for something else. I expect to be shuttled from one person to the next. I expect to speak with someone not very fluent in English named Steve, but sounding more like Pradeep or Sanjay. These are my expectations. No doubt, my customer service expectation isn't that favorable. My bank, and hundreds of other banks like it, get away with this crappy service because it is now our expectation. However, let's flip this scenario on its rear. What if I called the bank and instead of the voicemail rat maze, my call is immediately answered by an English-speaking person? No voicemail, no press 1, no press 2, no automated attendant. I get a real person answering the phone, like you answer your phone. After 5 minutes of speaking to the customer service rep, my problem is addressed and resolved, and heck, I wasn't even transferred to another agent. I'd be like, holy mother of God, wow. This is a sucks event, a superior unexpected customer service event. It is a transformation from customer service that naturally sucks to sucks, S-U-C-S. You see, when you violate your client's customer service expectation profile positively, you turn your customers into loyal, repeat buyers, and ultimately, disciples of your business. Leverage free human resource systems. One passive income system is human resource systems, good old-fashioned people. Except that employees aren't cheap, so human resource systems typically need management. Wouldn't it be great if you could deploy a human resource system for free? You can when you create disciples for your business. Customer service that sucks, S-U-C-S, service that violates your customer's low expectation profile positively, turns customers into lifelong clients and disciples of your business. They provide a never-ending stream of free advertising. Word of mouth is a powerful advertising tool because it's free and reaps infinite return on investment, or ROI. Your customer service strategy will influence your company's growth. Satisfaction implies expectations being met. To create raving customers, you must exceed satisfaction. When I negotiated with potential buyers for my company, I was asked frequently, how much do you spend to recruit advertisers? My unexpected answer? Zero. Skepticism followed. Sure, I did it the old-fashioned way when I started, prospecting, marketing, advertising, and cold calling, But after a while, my advertiser acquisition cost disappeared because my advertisers did it for me, for free. When your clients love your business, they become disciples and advertise for you. They become unpaid human resource systems, evangelists, who drop your name wherever necessary. How do you create disciples for your business? Provide customer service that sucks. Superior, unexpected customer service. When you send an email to a corporation, how long does it take to get a real human response? A day? A week? At my company, I answered my customers' emails within minutes, not hours, days, or weeks. People would email us just to test our response rate. I was in business to violate my customers' expectation profile, and it paid dividends. I followed this up with live customer service. A call to my company got a real person that worked for the real company. No press one or press two. Support wasn't outsourced because I didn't want service outsourced. Customer discipleship grows businesses exponentially because human resource systems talk. For example, my web hosting provider is Liquid Web. First time I contacted Liquid Web for technical support, I submitted a ticket and my expectation profile formed. I speculated it'd be a day or two before I heard back. I was wrong. Within 10 minutes, Liquid Web support responded and fixed my issue within just 20 minutes. They provided customer service that sucks, S-U-C-S, and violated expectations. The result? I'm now a disciple of Liquid Web. When someone asks me, "What kind of hosting do you recommend?" I confidently respond with Liquid Web. I'm an evangelic customer. I pay Liquid Web in two forms of currency. Number one, my money, and number two, my frequent recommendation of their service. The effective value of this latter currency is priceless because I'm now their free human resource system selling their product. Imagine the potency when you have not just one raving customer, but 10,000. Will your business grow 2% in 1 year or 200%? To provide great customer service and explode your business, determine your customer's expectation profile. What are their expectations when they deal with your business? How do they relate to competitors and similar businesses in your industry? Make a subjective call on how your customer service expect service. Then, violate it. Anytime you violate your customer's expectations to the positive, you get a dual benefit. First, they buy from you again. Second, raving customers become liaisons and disciples for your business and unpaid human resource systems. Both build speed, and speed builds wealth. Great customer service costs more to provide, but the benefits should outweigh the costs. If more money were spent on pleasing existing clients rather than trying to find new ones, the average business would survive longer than 5 years. Business owners who seek money first and needs last often spend their advertising wad on the pursuit of new customers who aren't familiar with their uninspired and sucky customer service. It becomes a constant battle, like emptying a leaky boat with a bucket. Replace the old, disgruntled customers with newer, oblivious ones. Violate customers' expectations. Create evangelists. Create human resource systems that will work for you, for free. Attract money. Where are your loyalties? The greatest myth of business ownership is the old, be your own boss. Owners who live by that mantra eventually find themselves bosses of nothing, dead, bankrupted businesses. Success in business comes from making your customer the boss and the number one stakeholder to your business. A stakeholder is defined as a person, group, or organization that has direct or indirect stake in an organization because it can affect or be affected by the organization's actions, objectives, and policies. Long-term business suicide occurs when you are your own selfish stakeholder and forsake your customer. Want to really know why customer service sucks? It's because business owners place their customers at the bottom of the stakeholder chain. Public companies are the worst offenders, as shareholders come first, Wall Street second, and executives third. Guess who sits at the bottom? You and I. My repeated and often preached motto to my employees was, the customer pays your paycheck, not me. Keep them happy. You see, my stakeholder wasn't my selfish desires for fast cars and big houses. It was my customer, because I knew they had the power. My loyalty was with my customer. Yes, I had a boss, and the boss had the keys to everything I selfishly wanted. Look big, act small. During Mr. Miller's gym class in my sophomore year of high school, I became aware of Mark Seagraves, except there was no such student. Mr. Miller had a knack for butchering the simplest of names. Henderson became Hankerson, Seagroves became Seagraves, and Rickson became Rakesh. No matter what your name was, Mr. Miller would shred it. I don't know if he was illiterate or just old. So fast forward more than a decade, and who is listed on my website as my chief technology officer? Mark Seagraves. Oh, and look who's my web developer. Gretchen Hankerson. Wow, so did I hire my friends from high school? No, I didn't. Especially since their names were just mere illusions of the real people. None of these people worked for me. Yet if you visited my website's contact or about us page, they were listed as employees in high-profile positions, CTO, business development, or web producer. These people weren't employees, but it looked like my staff was big and growing. Now I admit, this started off as a harmless inside joke with my employees, but I eventually realized it had a benefit. It was making my product look big, dominating, well-funded, growing. Of course, I'm not sure if butchered names from a 1987 gym class serving as employee apparitions was ethical, but my purpose and intention was clear. I wanted to look big and act small. Setting up sucks, S-U-C-S. Big companies notoriously give poor service as a model of expectation. Meanwhile, small companies are known to give better service with a personal touch. My objective was to look like I had the power of a big company, yet give personal service as if I were a one-person operation. When you receive personal, exceptional service from a big company, you create sucks events and create loyal, evangelic customers. Anywhere customer service is expected to suck, you have a business opportunity. Looking big and acting small is a setup for sucks events. The customer expects mediocre service from the start. This tactic works well for any company that operates without a physical presence. Obviously, you can't look big if you own a small retail store, but for those of us with internet companies, you can. The trap that snares many business owners is the extreme opposite. They look small and act big.
Joe Blow Enterprises.
Does this give you confidence that you're dealing with a strong, reputable company? This company name screams, this is a one-man show, and says nothing substantial or attractive. Sorry, Joe Blow Enterprises is a monumental fail. I'm sure the logo is non-existent, and if there were one, it'd be bland, boring, or look like it was designed using some freeware paint program. This company's website is static, stale, and childlike. No, Comic Sans doesn't cut it for a professional image. This company sells to the world, but it doesn't have a toll-free number. Small, small, small. The problem compounds when their smallest business operates with biggish company actions. Call their business and you get a long maze of buttons to press, only to land at the bottom of a voicemail dump. Send an email? Forget it. Most emails are ignored, and the ones read are answered weeks later. I'll get back to you. Never happens. Customer service issues aren't resolved in hours, but in weeks. If you insist on working 4 hours a week, your business won't grow because your selfishness is more important than growing a business meteorically. Look small and act big, and you dig your own potholes. Beat competitors before they start. My other purpose for looking big was to beat my competition before they even started. When someone or some company wants to set up shop and compete with you, they investigate you first. They look at your website, see what you're doing and the prices you're charging, and decide if they want to invest money and time into the space. To the untrained entrepreneur, a big company would scare would-be entrepreneurs almost like it scared me away. Oh, geez, how can I compete when they have 12 employees against little old me? If an entrepreneur thinks they can't compete with you because you're too big and too well-funded, you've won before they even started. They either engage half-heartedly or defer to another industry with duller competition. Look big, but act small. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Complaints are valuable insights into your customers' minds. Complaints of change are difficult to decipher and often require additional data to validate or invalidate. Complaints of expectation expose operational problems in either your business or in your marketing strategy. Complaints of void expose unmet needs, raise the value of your product or service, and expose new revenue opportunities. Great customer service is as simple as violating your customer's low expectation in the positive. Poor service gaps are fast lane opportunities. Satisfied customers can be human resource systems who promote your business for free. Satisfied customers have a dual residual effect, repeat business and new business via discipleship. Your customer and their satisfaction hold the key to everything you selfishly want. Looking big but acting small sets up customer service expectation violations in the positive. Looking big can scare away potential competitors. Chapter 41, Throw Hijackers to the Curb. People are definitely a company's greatest asset. It doesn't make any difference whether the product is cars or cosmetics. A company is only as good as the people it keeps. Mary Kay Ash. Your castle is mismanaged. Your castle is your business. If you put crooks in the castle, expect trouble. Returning to our chess analogy, the rook, or the castle, represents the people you put in your business. This includes employees, partners, investors, and advisors. The business marriage, partners. A business partner is like being married. It either works fabulously or ends in fiery divorce.
3 years ago, Jim and Mike were drinking at a bar, and a legendary idea was born that compelled them to start a business together. Their only consideration for the union was their excitement. They agreed to do a 50-50 profit split and zealously began. Mike finds their first client while Jim finds the second. Within a few months, their client base expands to 28, enough of both of them to draw a profit and quit their daytime jobs. After 2 years, Jim's time on the job and the quality of work starts to suffer. Not that Mike knows what Jim is doing every minute of the day, but he notices something that concerns him. For every 4 clients Mike brings to the company, Jim brings 1, and sometimes none. He later learns that Jim read a book that advocates working 4 hours a week. And to make matters worse, Jim's clients are not supported well, and Mike has to take up the slack. Yet every Friday, like clockwork, Jim is there to get his 50-50 cut. When Mike brings this to Jim's attention, Jim gets defensive and tensions mount. This confrontation only decreases Jim's productivity to where he sometimes doesn't have a new client for months. Mike tries to dissolve the partnership, and Jim resists. Why shouldn't he? He's collecting 50% profits on Mike's effort. Mike ultimately has to hire a lawyer and seek a legal remedy. A few years later, the partnership is dissolved, and along with it, Mike and Jim's friendship.
Partnerships are like marriages. After the love affair and the lust wears off, they must survive on character, synergy, and complementary attributes. My early entrepreneurial ventures were all partnerships and all miserable failures. Not that my partners were bad people, but our work ethics, values, and visions were not compatible. I remember one partner had a normal 9-to-5 job and was active in intramural sports. The business was number 4 or 5 on his priority list. The other partner was out working for other businesses, including ours. That left my business and me, which was priority numero uno. Do you see an issue here? Search the Fastlane forum for partnership, and you'll find a garden of complaints about partnerships gone bad. One partner wants to expand, the other wants to brand. One partner wants to advertise, the other wants to develop. One partner wants the expensive cars and the money, yet arrives at the office late and leaves early. Partnerships are like marriage. Half the time they will fail because the partners just aren't compatible. They say you should partner with people who have complementary skills to you. That means if I'm a marketing guy, I should partner with a technical guy. If you're a sales and people guy, you should partner with an analytical guy. While this is a great starting point to find a partner, it's like marrying the first person you date simply because they had big boobs or look like Brad Pitt. Many other personality characteristics will make or break a partnership. Here are a few. Do you have the same work ethic? Will your partner skate while you burn the midnight oil? Do you have the same vision? Or will they compete with each other? Do you want to grow slowly while your partner wants to own the world and do it fast? Do you want to sell franchises while your partner just wants one unit that will pay the bills? Do you trust this person with your life? Do you have the same personality type? The fact is, people engage in partnerships for the wrong reasons. Like people start businesses under false premises, not need-oriented, they also form partnerships under a similar false premise, diversification. The partners don't seek synergy, they seek diversification of risk, expense, and workload. Often, each partner looks to each other for the burden to bear, and when one bears more, resentment builds. Partnerships can work just like a lot of marriages work. Just make sure who you know you're getting engaged to. A 2-week honeymoon with your college roommate might not be enough courtship to determine compatibility. Would you marry someone after 2 weeks of dating? Get A+ A's. I've had many verbal negotiations with investors, and when the 90-page legalese document arrived on my desk, what was said and what was written were two different things. We discussed an amortized note at 10% over 5 years, so why does it say 5% over 10? Who exposed the incongruity buried in an avalanche of legal jargon? Not me, it was my attorney. Then there was a time when a simple omission on a business expense can cost you thousands of dollars in taxes. Who knows that a 38,000 interactive voice response system is depreciable when you think it's just some overpriced telephone system? An accountant. If I didn't have a good team of A's, accountants, and attorneys, I'd be poorer. And yes, these people aren't easy to find because they're like partners under contract, another group of individuals who have the keys to your castle. Don't be an idiot like me. Still green, I remember my first accountant, found right out of the Yellow Pages, not from referral, but blind hope. It didn't take long to see that she wasn't concerned with tax planning. No questions about my business or my concerns, just zeal to complete the forms and get it done. Additionally, most of her clients were slow laners who dabbled with W-2s and 401Ks rather than corporations. Great pick, MJ. I needed someone with a fast-lane business mindset, and I committed to finding one. After interviewing and investigating a half dozen accountants, I found one whose clients were primarily business owners. Be very careful with whom you trust with the keys to your castle. Remember Nicolas Cage. His manager allegedly drove him to the precipice of financial ruin. Investigate and interview. Get referrals from successful, established entrepreneurs. Treat your two A's like you would any partner, because they have unfettered access to your castle, and those with the keys have the potential to steer you wrong. Would you like a chainsaw with your beer? When you blindly trust others to anything, business, financial investments, security, you're vulnerable to being conned. There's an old beer commercial in which a couple is driving down a dark country road, and they spot a hitchhiker with a case of beer and a live chainsaw. The driver wants to pick up the hitchhiker because he advertises something he wants, the beer, but is blind to the chainsaw. Blind trust can be like picking up a hitchhiker on a dark, deserted road, hoping to tap into his case of beer, but not seeing the torture device behind his back. You must make your trust an asset to be earned by others. Let action speak louder than words. When you allow words to disarm your trust or BS meter, you become vulnerable to attack. When you pick up hitchhikers and salivate at their case of beer, you might be blindsided to their chainsaw. One of the worst employees I ever hired was a pathological liar who stole from me. Well, why on earth did I hire her? She disarmed me with words. During the interview process, she told me she sang in the church choir and was a religious woman. While I didn't ask anything pertaining to religion, she assumed that I assigned honesty to religion. Well, she was right, and it dismantled my defenses. I hired her without verification, and it took me several years to uncover the truth. Verify first, trust later. Former President Ronald Reagan once said, "Trust, but verify." When I hired the liar, I trusted, but didn't verify. It took several robberies, video cameras, and public record searches to uncover the truth. I verified too late, and it cost me. The most egregious cases of trust are our financial system. Bernard Madoff perpetrated the largest Ponzi scheme ever, and billions of dollars were lost. How does one man siphon billions from millions? Unverified trust. Thousands trusted Madoff, and thousands failed to verify. Those who did verify didn't invest, and some even blew the whistle. We are a trusting people, and we want to believe the best. We want to believe in fairy tales and happily ever after. We want to believe that for two easy payments of $39.95, we can make millions investing in no-money-down real estate. When I started my entrepreneurial career fresh out of college, I trusted everyone. I bought all kinds of crazy schemes that promised me a road to wealth. What happens when you trust everyone? You get burned. You get lazy. You hire criminals. When you trust everyone, you engage in business opportunities that violate the commandment of control. You allow others to dictate your financial road trip. And when that happens, you crash and burn. There's only one person you can blindly trust in this world, and that is you. So, why am I so cynical? If you don't understand now, you will later. When you serve millions, you come in contact with millions. Only then will you understand the essence of the consumer-producer equation. Your eyes will be open to how many people will go the extra mile to screw you. There is no safe place from liars, con artists, thieves, and crooks. These people commiserate in the least likely of places. Your community church, that harmonic dating website, and at your posh country club. If I lose $10,000 on an investment that I meticulously investigated, I can deal with it. Easy come, easy go. Yet, if I have $10,000 stolen from me because I blindly trusted someone who I let into my vehicle, it's different. Today I trust no one, but give everyone the opportunity to prove trust. There's a lot of good people out there, and they do outnumber the bad by a wide margin. It just takes a mild effort to find them and keep them in your life. Just be careful who you pick up on the side of the road. Don't be tempted by a cold brew, but be blinded to the chainsaw. Fire reckless chauffeurs. Are inmates running the asylum? When you're not home, who runs the castle? Who chauffeurs your business? Providing great customer service is one thing. Getting employees to deliver it is another. When you shift your focus to the bottom line, often the front line is sacrificed. How much is that untrained $8 an hour front desk person with a bad attitude really costing you? To make customers disciples of your business, employees have to share your customer service philosophy. You can't let any employee ruin a multi-million dollar investment. All the intangibles in the world can't change a poor customer service experience. After a 9-day stay in Las Vegas, I learned how robotic service is the ultimate of business liabilities, regardless of poshness. Most people vacation to Vegas to escape from coworkers, incompetent employees, dirty houses, traffic, and your typical menagerie of life's dramas. Vegas is supposed to be an escape. Compliments of my friend's company, which was participating in a convention, my Vegas stay started at the Rio Hotel. I never stayed at the Rio and normally wouldn't consider this hotel. The hotel was somewhat hoary and dated, the bed was stiff and the accommodations worn. Nonetheless, I found the staff very nice. The dealers were friendly and the casino staff was accommodating to our minor requests. I enjoyed my stay. After 3 days at the Rio, I transferred over to the Venetian Hotel, a hotel that my American Express concierge arranged. For those unfamiliar with the Venetian, it is a new hotel with opulent architecture, ornate columns and corbels, lavish chandeliers, and other affluent appointments that would make anyone feel like royalty. My stay at the Venetian was for 6 days. Unfortunately, after 6 days, I vow I will never return. Love the fancy Italian architecture, but their people suck. Our nightmare started on day one and continued every single day, marred by poor human experiences. Unresponsive housekeeping, unacceptable hold time to hotel services, failure to deliver promises, mechanized staff, overcharging, and overall a failure to provide an escape. There are two critical lessons in this experience. Number one, a SOX, S-U-C-S, customer service philosophy must be delivered by your employees. And number two, spectacular product features can't overcome poor service. First, employees must deliver your customer service philosophy. Your people are ambassadors of your business, and they communicate your vision. Essentially, they're business chauffeurs, and if they're reckless, your vision is destroyed. Your employees drive the public perception of your company. Now, was it the Venetian's policy to treat me with such disrespect and disinterest? That's probably doubtful. The failure was in the communication lines from management to employee. Not just one employee, but several. You can't be driving the ship all day. Your employees carry the water buckets, and if they aren't ordained in service, they hijack businesses and create liabilities. Customer service philosophy is irrelevant if employees don't translate that philosophy into frontline action. The second lesson is this. No amount of spectacular product features, such as great technology or great architecture, can compensate for poor customer service. Despite the Venetian's billion-dollar appearance, the marble floors and the ornate columns, their customer service sucked. Yet at the Rio Hotel, customer service was excellent, which translated into a great experience, despite the hotel's dated building. This incongruity represents a one-way street. Fanatical customer service, or service that sucks, S-U-C-S, can help compensate for shortcomings. But fanatical features cannot compensate for poor customer service, or poor human interaction. The Venetian's floor could have been made of solid gold. It wouldn't have mattered. Nothing overcomes poor human experiences. You could own the best hotel in the world located on the best beach in California, but if customers are treated like inconveniences and requests go unfulfilled, they won't return. Exponential business growth is fueled by fanatical customer service, and your frontline employees must share that vision. It doesn't come from boastful mission statements plastered on the CEO's office wall. Chapter Summary, Fastlane Distinctions. A business partnership is as important as a marriage. A good accountant and attorney will save you thousands, perhaps millions. Accountants and attorneys have the keys to your castle. Make sure you trust them fully because they have the power to right or wrong you. Unmitigated trust exposes you to unmitigated risk. Unverified trust can lead to uncontrollable consequences. Your employees communicate the public's perception of your company. Fanatical customer service can overcome shortcomings, but fanatical features can't overcome poor customer service. Customer service philosophy is delivered from human interactions, not ambitious mission statements on a wall plaque in a CEO's office. Chapter 42, Be Someone's Savior. A market is never saturated with a good product, but it is very quickly saturated with a bad one. Henry Ford. Your knight in shining armor. Is your product or service the knight in shining armor for someone? Is it going to save the day? Or is your knight cut from the fabric of selfishness, fueled by your hopes that it will gallop in on a black stallion and make you rich while simultaneously allowing you to be your own boss? The crowded world of Me Too. Me Too businesses make Me Too incomes. It isn't hard to find businesses founded on something other than a need. They have no differentiation or uniqueness, and they sink into a crowded abyss of Me Too and make their business owners crazy once the illusion of Be Your Own Boss fades. Businesses founded on false premises will rocket to the bin of commoditization and force you to do the inevitable, to play checkers. So what is commoditization? Commoditization is a product or service that appears homogenous among providers. For example, a service that has been heavily commoditized is air travel. Most people aren't loyal to any particular airline. They're loyal to the company with the best price. The product becomes commoditized. Another example is gas. I get gas at any 7 different gas stations because the product is commoditized. People tend to make buying decisions for commoditized goods and services based on one metric, price. If you don't, it's because the business has done a good job differentiating its product from the alternatives. If your product doesn't stand out in the crowd, it doesn't stand a chance, and you're forced into the strategy of cutting prices to stand out from the crowd. Get into business for the right reason. So why are you in business? Most likely for the wrong reason. A perfect example is the limo industry, where new companies recirculate like turnstiles at the train station. What compels someone to open a limousine business? Rarely because of need. Nope, people get into the business because they are fulfilling their own selfish need, because they just want to, just like I wanted to years ago. In fact, the limo business appears to be some sort of graduation from taxi driver. Did the market need a new limousine company? Was their intent to deliver a superior product that stands above the competition? Nope, the intent was selfish. I want to own a limo company, so I'm going to start one. This creates excess supply and weak demand. Too many limos running around and not enough customers. When supply exceeds demand, prices must drop. Suddenly, the product becomes commoditized. Your total disregard toward market needs leads down the road to commoditization, where you must sell your soul to the buyer who wants the cheapest price. Where does this insanity start? People start businesses they have no business starting. People start businesses doing what they love or doing what they know. A gentleman who owns a carpet cleaning business posted a similar story at the Fastlane forum. He wrote,
"The problem is that although I provide incredible value for what I do, it is based on something that people don't want to buy. People will avoid cleaning their carpets for as long as physically possible. So in reality, I'm providing something that is of little value. Thus, I can conclude that I need to change my business premise. So what values do I change my business premise to target? What do people value today? I think I'm in a business that is based upon a bad business premise."
I feel bad for this man. Why is he in the carpet cleaning business? Because there was a genuine need, or because he needed a job and wanted his own business? Regardless of the reason, he operates in an industry where the service is commoditized. Business owners fight over every customer while they earn fewer and fewer dollars for each. If he wants to grow, he has to cut his price. My response was that you can't change your business premise because you are already in business. The right business premise would have steered you clear of the industry or got you in the business to attack an unfilled need. When hundreds of people get into business solely because they know how or want to, and it is not based on need, you get put into the position you are in, price wars, haggling over a few dollars. There is limited need or limited demand and too many providers or excess supply. The point of having a need-based premise is to avoid the industry entirely or to get into it to solve a specific problem, not to change it after the fact. If your product isn't someone's knight, standing out from the crowd and differentiating, it stands to be commoditized. Get your eyes off the competition's ass. Although my internet service was for consumers, my paying customers were small business owners. When you interact with hundreds of small business owners on a daily basis, you get a keen insight into how they approach business. I mistakenly assumed that all business owners thought like I did, when their predisposition was often the opposite. I learned fast that most business owners paid more attention to their competition than to their own business. Instead of minding their own business, they had their noses into everything else that everyone else was doing. When this happens, you neglect your own product and you become reactive instead of proactive. So are your eyes on the vehicle and the road ahead? Or are you rubbernecking at all the cars around you? Oh no, Excel Limousine dropped its hourly rate by $5. Mercy, call out the price police. Heavens, Godfrey Limousine is advertising its 2009 model limo when it's a 2003 model. I'm calling my attorney. If your eyes are glued to the competition's butt, guess what? Your eyes aren't on the road ahead. If you're following, you aren't leading, and if you aren't leading, you're not innovating. If Company X does something and you react, you are being reactive, not proactive. Why aren't they following your lead? If your preoccupation is with every single thing your competition does, you're cheating your business and your customers. How to use your competition. Another dead professor moment. Forget about your competition 95% of the time. The other 5% should be used to exploit their weaknesses and differentiate your business. If you forget about the competition, you're forced to focus on your business, which is to innovate and win the hearts and minds of your customers. And when you fill needs and your army of customers grow, suddenly something miraculous happens. Everyone follows you. In my industry, I led the pack. I innovated and everyone followed me. If I instituted a new feature, my competition would add the same thing months later. I introduced a lead generation revenue model, and it was copied dozens of times. My eyes weren't affixed to everyone else because I was preoccupied with my own success and the satisfaction of my customers. On the rare occasions you peek in at your competition, do so for exploitation. Mind their weaknesses and differentiate your product. Uncover what you should be doing that they aren't. Find the need. Exploit their customer service gaffes. Is it impossible to receive good service? Do dissatisfied customers litter the web with their displeasure? When I launched my limousine directory, my competition consisted of existing websites and the traditional yellow pages. The weakness of both was risk. To advertise, you had to pay a big upfront fee regardless of benefit. So if you spent $5,000 and acquired one new customer, you just spent $5,000 for one client. Scary risk proposition, huh? I thought this was too risky for business owners, so I sought to solve it. For mature companies, competition often serves to exploit what you shouldn't be doing versus what you should be doing. My closest competitor was never known to answer their email. This gave me an advantage. If you're going to take your eye off the road and examine your competitors, expose their weaknesses. Exploited weaknesses are where brands are built. Differentiation is a defense to commoditization. What are they doing wrong? What inefficiency is there? Within the gray area of unsatisfied customers lies differentiation. The only alternative to boorish Me Too goods and services is differentiation, and that is accomplished by innovation and analyzing your competitors' weaknesses. In other words, force innovation. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Commoditization occurs when you get into business based on a false premise. I want to own a business, or I know how to do this, so I'll start a business doing it. If you're too busy copying or watching your competition, you're not innovating. Use your competition to exploit their weaknesses. Chapter 43, Build Brands, Not Businesses. Everyone has an invisible sign hanging from their neck saying, "Make me feel important." Never forget that message when working with people. Mary Kay Ash. Queen Me, Marketing and Branding. In chess, lose your queen and you lose the game. In business, most entrepreneurs play the game without their captured queen. Have you ever bought a product from television and when you used it, it sucked and didn't perform as advertised? Then in dissatisfaction you tried to return it and got the runaround from a guy who sounded like he had a double-digit IQ? That is the power of marketing. Bad people, bad service, and bad product, but awesome marketing. If you have an okay product, a weak night, poor customer service, drunk bishops, and incompetent people, a castle full of idiots, you can survive with a powerful queen. The queen is the most powerful piece in chess, and it is also in business. Marketing can convince people to buy mediocre products. Marketing can hide or disguise service flaws. Marketing can shadow incompetence, and marketing can keep convicted felons disparate from their product. The power of marketing is that a powerful ad campaign can move products, regardless of the cockroaches hiding underneath. Marketing is a game of perceptions, and whatever the perception is, that's the reality. Build a brand, not a business. Businesses survive. Brands thrive. A brand is the best defense to commoditization. When your business is in business just to make money and pay the bills for the month, you're playing checkers and being one-dimensional. People are loyal to brands and relationships, not corporations or businesses. I love Coke and I hate Pepsi. I'm loyal to Coke and I don't care if Pepsi suddenly becomes $1 cheaper. I'll always buy Coke. Coke has built a brand, and the power of that brand is a firm loyalty that is difficult to sever. Is Coke objectively better than Pepsi? I don't know, or I don't care. When you think about the automobile Volvo, what do you think of? I think safety. How about Porsche? I think speed. How about Ferrari? I think rich. Volkswagen? Practical. Toyota? Reliability. Yet, when someone mentions Chevrolet, nothing clear comes to mind other than looming bankruptcy, union squabbles, and unpredictable reliability. Some auto manufacturers have carved out strong brands while the others fortify a business. Our friend with the carpet cleaning business also has a business and not a brand. Brands don't have identity crises. Businesses do. If our friend wants to excel in an industry saturated with Me Toos, he's going to have to brand and differentiate himself. He needs to be a Lamborghini in a traffic jam of Chevys. What will make his carpet cleaning business different from the rest? Why should people hire him, even though his prices might be 20% higher? These tough questions have tough answers, especially since his entry in the industry was based upon a faulty premise. However, upon further investigation, most of his unscrupulous competitors used bait-and-switch advertising tactics gummed down with fine print. Perhaps this industry weakness is exploitable. My challenge to him was to leverage that nuisance. Perhaps he can brand himself as a no-nonsense carpet cleaner. Fixed prices, no surcharges, and no fine print. Apple, the computer maker, is a great example of building a brand based upon a need or a nuisance. People hate viruses, spyware, and the constant "your updates are ready" messages that are associated with PC computers. Apple exploited PCs' weaknesses and solved their problems. It has built itself into one of the most successful brands in history. Apple isn't the cheapest because they've engineered a brand and they can demand a higher price. Say Apple, and many images come to mind. Creative, trendy, easy, and hip. When I think of PC, I think of blue screens, illegal operations, and you must reboot your computer 17 times before this update takes effect. One is a business. The other is a brand. Get unique, the USP. The first step at building a brand is to have a unique selling proposition, or a USP. As a business without one, you're adrift in a sea of me-too businesses, without a rudder, unmoored to the trade winds of the marketplace. USP-less businesses offer nothing distinct, nothing unique, no benefit, no logical reason that someone should buy from them other than hope or circumstance wrapped around a cheap price. Your USP is the anchor to your brand. What makes your company different from the rest? What sets your business apart? What will compel a customer to use you over someone else? My USP was powerful. No risk advertising. If we send you nothing, you pay nothing. Advertisers joined by the truckload because they were tired of advertising with the Yellow Pages, which offered this risk proposition. Pay us $5,000 up front, then hope and pray. I exposed a pain point and fixed it. Our carpet cleaner had no USP. Nothing set him apart, as he might as well have been just a lonely grain of rice in a 50-pound bag of feed. USPs are the building blocks to brands and can compensate for higher prices or even an inferior product. FedEx was introduced to the world when it said, "When your package absolutely positively has to be there overnight." M&M's said, "The milk chocolate melts in your mouth, not in your hand." Notice how these USPs target benefits. I don't like Domino's Pizza, despite once being employed by them, and yet that didn't stop them from building a pizza empire based upon the USP of delivered to your door in 30 minutes or less, or it's free. Domino's identified the need. Pizza delivery is a long ordeal. They solved it, branded it, and the rest is history. So how did Domino's infiltrate such a crowded market space and succeed? Branding and marketing, the queen in the chess game. Developing your USP. How do you develop a solid USP for your company? There are five simple steps. Step 1, uncover the benefit. Get into business for the right reason, to solve a problem or a need. That creates your first USP. If you are already in business, find the great benefit of your product, one that sets it apart from the competition. Do this with your customer in mind. Think about their needs and their wants. Step number 2, be unique. The objective of the USP is to be unique when compared to the alternatives. This impregnates the consumer with a logical argument for choosing your company because without your company, they are foregoing the benefit. USPs should use powerful action verbs that create desire and urgency. Lose weight should be changed to obliterate fat or shred pounds. Grow your business should be dropped in favor of explode revenues or shatter sales records. The uniqueness of your USP creates a consumer divergence when it comes to their buying decision. If you pick a Mac over a PC, you are choosing safety, speed, and reliability over viruses and bloatware. Step 3, be specific and give evidence. Noise is everywhere, and if you are going to rise above it, you have to alleviate natural consumer skepticism. Do so by being specific, and if possible, offer evidence. Website. Your car sold in 20 days or less, or it's free. Product. Drop 20 pounds or you don't pay a dime. Service. Your home sold in 30 days or less, or I own it. Domino's Pizza didn't say delivered on time. They said delivered within 30 minutes or it's free. It was a specific action and evidence of that action. Your pizza is free if we don't perform. In my case, the onus was on me to send my advertisers Leads. If I didn't get paid. We send your business or you don't pay a dime. Step 4. Keep it short, clear, and concise. The best USPs are short, clear, and powerful. Long for